From the beginning of my presidency, we've been clear-eyed that we need to attack this virus globally as well. This is about our responsibility, our humanitarian obligation to save as many lives as we can.
In 2020, Australia deployed new renewables 8 times faster per capita than the global average and nearly 3 times faster than the United States, China and the EU.
I have never heard something so insane in my life. The idea that somehow we should be promoting the idea of armed conflict with a superpower is madness.
This Tamil asylum seeker family has been held in detention on Christmas Island since 2019. Today, in an interview, Karen Andrews said that her comments were general remarks and she was not talking about this individual case.
No, I have not raised that particular family with either New Zealand or the United States.
This proposal was developed by the New South Wales government. The universities will make their own decisions on which students come back first, but most of us, I think, will bring back the students who have almost completed their degrees.
The wrap.
Diving straight into the biggest news stories of the week. Maybe you are carrying around a couple of extra questions, harbouring opinions, you're unsure of how to vocalise, or simply feeling you've missed a couple of headlines. Luckily, we are going to be joined right now by two excellent experts to scrutinise and review the week for us. Joining us this evening, Amy Coops is the editor of Crokey Health Media News and a doctor in training, and Peter Harcher is political editor and international editor for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Peter.
Good day, Patricia.
Let's start with what's just actually happened, the Prime Minister landing in the UK and ready for action on G7. Leaders from 7 democracies across the world have arrived in the UK today ahead of that G7 summit. And we're not officially in, but we are invited. There are going to be discussions on trade, on COVID-19, but climate change as well. Just want to start with you, if I can, Peter Harcher. This is a pretty pivotal and important moment. What does Australia have to do here?
On climate change, you mean?
On everything. I'm making everything. It a broad well, question, a and then I'll zoom in again after that.
Okay. Well, Australia's invited to the G7. This is the third time now, which indicates that Australia being included as sort of an ex officio special guest has some particular relevance to the shared concerns of the Group of Seven, which are the richest, you know, big industrial democracies. And the particular relevance it has different subsets of topics, but the overriding one for the Americans, the Europeans, the Brits, the Japanese, that they share with Australia at the moment is China. Everybody has a shared concern over China's increased disruptive and aggressive tactics and what to do about it. So that's one big one, and that's one where Australia has a lot to say and a lot to ask and a lot to suggest, and that's top of Morrison's mind. But there's also, as you say, climate change, and that's one where the host of this particular meeting, Boris Johnson, has really got that at the top of his agenda. It's not at the moment at the top of Scott Morrison's agenda. So there's a mismatch there, and Morrison's not interested in moving on that yet, although Morrison has said that Australia will produce a full paper, a full policy on emissions reduction in time for the Glasgow summit, which Boris Johnson will also be hosting later this year in November.
Now, they're the sort of macro issues, but then on a sort of COVID level, I know that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says G7 nations need to do more and they'll pledge to give 1 billion coronavirus vaccine doses to poorer countries. Amy, what do you make of that announcement? Is that a good sort of right in the right direction? Are they doing enough heavy lifting on this?
I mean, certainly it's in the right direction. It's welcome. I mean, no one would say that it's not a welcome development, but I think there's a little bit of forest for the trees here. I think, you know, it's maintaining a status quo. I mean, MSF and others have made the argument that, in fact, the G7 countries, the wealthy nations of the world, are the ones who have created a situation that we are in where there's incredible disparity and, you know, a socioeconomic gradient between the treatments and access to vaccines between the richest countries of the world and the poorest countries. So, like, the vaccination program globally, 28% of vaccines administered so far have been administered in G7 countries, 0.3% have been administered in developing nations. So I think, you know, it's great to kind of put your hand out, so to speak, and say, look at how generous we are. And obviously this is like a very necessary development. But I think there's also the scale of the problem. Like, you cannot underestimate the scale of the problem. So I think Oxfam has estimated that there's 4 billion people in the world, 4 billion, who will require COVAX to access a COVID vaccine. If you're talking about 1 billion vaccines here and it's only 500 million that are going to be delivered anytime soon, the other 500 million is not going to be till next year sometime. We've seen how quickly the COVID situation, Patricia would know all too well, how quickly the situation can develop, you know, in a matter of days, weeks, not a matter of months. We don't know what the situation is going to look like, you know, in 6 months, 9 months, 10 months time. So I think, the rhetoric is welcome, but I think it's not the right direction. I think what really needs to happen is there needs to be some leadership on this, and there needs to be some acceptance of, you know, things like the TRIPS waiver. We should be expanding global capacity to manufacture vaccines domestically for these countries. That's the only way that we're going to be able to lift ourselves out of the situation that we're in. Like, I don't think that, you know, 500 million, whatever band-aid solution is quite going to cut it when the scale of the problem is as it is.
And Peter, how have such pledges of vaccines been distributed to developing nations before? I mean, they've been promised before. Do you think that this will be a game changer?
Well, you're right. There's been a few different initiatives and bits and pieces. In March, the Quad countries met at the summit level, at the leader level for the first time, and that's Australia, Japan, the United States, and India. And those four countries in March promised a billion doses, another billion doses, and some of the same countries, because three of those four countries from the Quad are also around the table at the G7. And they promised then a billion doses for the least developed countries of Southeast Asia, Asia and the Pacific, although they didn't, the timeline on that wasn't until the end of next year. Plus, you've got multi-billion dollar pledges of almost all the rich countries to the COVAX syndicate, which is the international framework, the agreed international official framework for getting vaccines distributed, funded and distributed from the rich world into the poor world. So you've got all these overlapping commitments, and yet, Amy's quoted some pretty compelling stats, and the ones that the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, quoted again this week is very similar, but slightly different parameters, that 44% of all vaccines yet distributed have gone into the arms of people in rich countries, and 0.4% have gone into the arms of people in poor. And he said, and my immense frustration is that those numbers don't shift week to week. So we've got a lot of talk and a lot of promises, but we really are just seeing a failure of execution.
Yeah, and there was something interesting that the Prime Minister just said on arrival there, Amy, that I wanted to put to both of you. And he was talking about the high rates of first doses, at least, of vaccination in the UK, and the fact that they still have high numbers of the virus, not as high as it was, and no serious illness. But it seemed to me like a warning shot that, you know, when we let the virus in or we change our settings, that even when we're highly vaccinated, and that was his point, like the UK are, we are going to have to deal with COVID running through the community. Am I reading it right?
I think the fact of the matter is that this is going to be the next phase, isn't it? That we're going to have to contemplate.
Talking about it. Yeah,
that's right. We can't live in domestic lockdown or, you know, any situation such as we are for, you know, forever or for very much longer. I don't think there's much public kind of tolerance for this to go on for, you know, another decade or something until who knows what development they're expecting to happen. Like, I think we have to learn to figure out how we can live with the virus. I think that the public health experts have been saying that all along. I think it is really important, though, not to lose sight of the idea that vaccination is really key. And I think particularly completing a course of vaccination, like we've seen these variants of concern, particularly Delta, emerge. And the protection of the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, is excellent against the variants of concern still, but really only if there's the second dose. So I think it is really important that we get behind that idea. But I think we always knew that vaccines were only going to be one part of a suite of things that we needed to do, and perhaps not even the most important part. Like, I think the things that we've always needed to do are the things we still have to do now. we have to do the social distancing and the masking and all of that. And yes, the rolling domestic lockdowns. Like, I think we kind of knew that that was going to be a factor of life still this year. And I guess it remains to be seen, like, once we open the borders more broadly, how that's going to play out. I think we absolutely need to get our hotel quarantine house in order if we do hope to kind of, you know, open the borders more. But that, anyway, that's another question for another program.
But Peter Harcher, I thought the Prime Minister's comments were really interesting, just talking about the high rates of vaccination, yet still, you know, significant numbers of COVID compared to our numbers, at least, but much lower than they were. Is he trying to get us ready for something?
You mean he's trying to get us ready for a time when we've got vaccinations in our arms and yet rising numbers of COVID cases?
He's trying to, but then he's kind of scared because there's an election.
Yeah, I just think he wants us to be relaxed and comfortable.
Ooh.
The most likely date for the Australian federal election. And by that time, even at the current rate of vaccinations in Australia, almost everybody, or maybe even everybody who actually wants to be vaccinated, should still be able to get vaccinated by then. I think he wants to keep the borders shut and the vaccinations going out, and just reassure everybody that we can continue to have a high level of economic growth with high level of daily go about your daily life confidence in what Innes Woolix of the Australian Industry Group has called our gilded cage.
And it's a cage which we may feel differently about as time unfolds, right, Amy? That's the thing that you were saying. Yes, there was a period of time where it was very popular for the cage to be up, but at some point that may shift.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I was recently at the site of the College of Psychiatrists conference, and they were talking about the mental health impacts of COVID, which, you know, is front of mind for them and for many of us as well. And they were sort of talking about there's been phases of this journey, right? And we're in a new phase at the moment where I think we're in a bit of a holding pattern, and people want to lean into the idea that the country is open and more open than it was. You know, we can go about our lives more freely, and that the vaccine was seen as some kind of panacea. But now that's been accompanied by, I think, a bit of disappointment that actually, you know, the vaccines are rolling out, but in fact, you know, life hasn't changed all that much, and there's no prospect really of it changing dramatically anytime soon. Even if we do manage to kind of get our domestic vaccination up to scratch, variants of concern, until we fix this global problem, you know, until we get these disparities and these inequalities kind of addressed, we are always going to be staring down the barrel of another India or another kind of, you know, situation where there's a rip-roaring outbreak that creates selective pressure on the virus that enables it to mutate. You know, these are the conditions in which the virus is going to be able to evade everything that we're throwing at it. And so we need to redouble our efforts to kind of bring everybody on board. Like, that's got to be the end game for all of us. And I think, you know, that's why these conversations are really important this week about this issue.
Look, I just want to pause for a second and give you, Peter, a chance just to give us some analysis on what you make of the other element of the G7. So just moving away from COVID, but we're going to go back again because COVID's kind of like the overarching theme of our times. So we always have to go back whether I like it or not. And believe me, I don't always like it. But Peter, obviously China's the other big issue that's going to be on the agenda. What did you make of Beijing's reaction to the joint statement issued by Australia and Japan expressing concerns about Chinese military aggression?
Well, it's in the same vein as all of their, or almost all of their comments since Xi Jinping pushed the button on, you know, hyper-aggro, so-called wolf-warrior diplomacy early in the pandemic, and that is over the top, where, you know, a government expressing concern, even in measured tones, about China's activities, or in this case two governments, the Australian and Japanese governments together, is met with just really, I mean, quite silly. You know, it's standard now. They say that any comment by any country that in any way impinges on China is a violation of international law, and another outrageous exaggeration. So they're staying in that mode. Xi Jinping made a speech last week where he said China needs to project a more credible and lovable, the words, credible and lovable,
lovable
image to the world. Give us a big hug. Like, you know, we're just a friendly panda. But so long as as their military forces keep running these sorties into the contested airspace and maritime space of countries, you know, ranging from Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan, territorial conflicts with India, yelling at everybody all the time, and insulting them. Then I don't know if that's. I'd like to see his definition of lovable.
Now, I want to move back to COVID. There's so many things to talk about, but the consequences of trying to reshape the way we deal with COVID. And this week, international students, it was announced, could, because it hasn't happened yet, welcome back to New South Wales from as early as July. It's a pilot plan. It's been announced by the New South Wales government. They still need the approval, of course, of the federal government. They've got a plan, 250 students a fortnight, goes up to 500. Amy, obviously we know that the higher education system has been smashed by COVID, right? Mm. Is this a reasonable plan to try and sort of get into this space again?
I think it comes back to the conversation we were just having, which is we need to try and get back to some kind of normalisation. And I think, you know, opening the door like this to an industry that is not only suffered greatly, but has also very important to our economy and very important to not just like, you know, in financial terms, but, you know, in many other ways as well, including throughput of professionals, it's a smart move. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the federal government responds. I suspect they will sit back and be quiet about it and kind of let it happen and let it play out. And if it's a success, they will essentially co-opt it as their own brainchild. And if it fails, you know, if it causes outbreaks or whatever else, then they will be quick to stand up and go tut, 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 I'm sure. But I think, you know, it's an important step, and I think it will be very closely watched, and it should be very closely watched, but it will be a good litmus test of lots of things, one of which is, you know, how are we going to manage this controlled influx of people back into our country?
Mm. Peter, what do you think?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's an indication of yet another level where the states have run out of patience with the federal government to act on continuing to respond to the COVID crisis. You've seen two states already, Queensland and Victoria, trying to get deals with the federal government to move away from the, you know, continuously flawed hotel quarantine system and try and build dedicated cabin-based quarantine systems. That's one level. The second level, you see the states continuing to be impatient with the federal government's efforts at vaccine rollout and to create more and more of their own efforts at vaccine rollout. And now you see this, where the states are having to come up with their own plans to start bringing international students back because the federal government's sitting on its hands. So that's the first thing. It's, again, the states having to get more and more active as they get more and more frustrated with the Commonwealth. But the other thing I'd say, Patricia, is while, you know, it's a good idea to have a very small and cautious return to trying to get foreign students back into the country, if you're one of the 30,000 plus Australian citizens who's still sitting offshore trying to get home, and you've registered your intention already, and you've been waiting months or year or over a year to get back, you're not going to be very impressed to read or hear that foreign students are getting into your home before you are. Mm-hmm. So I'd suggest that this could be a lightning rod for more criticism of the from the Australians who can't get home and from their families who'd love them to get home but can't.
Now, we're going to shortchange the next topic. I literally have only a minute from both of you, but I'd like to know what you make of this call for the Bilawila family to be resettled in Australia, starting with you, Amy, and really I am time poor here, but just read between the lines. Do you think that there has been a shift?
I think we are seeing a definitely momentum, like a shift in the public imagination. I think those images were really powerful, and they should be, because I think it hones the public's kind of focus on what this is actually about, which is a family of four people, including two young children who were born in this country, who were whisked offshore, you know, under the cover of darkness, and have been living essentially in a prison for years offshore, out of sight, out of mind. To what end? You know, like, what is the end game here? The government's dug themselves into an impasse over this and seem to be kind of at a stalemate. Mm. But we've completely lost sight of the fact that these are human beings who have rights And it's heartbreaking to kind of see children suffering like this. What kind of a country are we that we're permissive to these kind of things?
Now, what do you think, Peter? Is there a shift in the government? Do you think they might let them stay?
I think they're going to see what happens. Their intention is not to let them stay, but because Liberal backbenchers are feeling pressure and public and media pressure is building, there's a fair chance that if the pressure stays on, and we've got two sitting weeks of Parliament coming up, and if the Labor Party makes enough noise about it and the public care enough, the government could well change its mind, because in my personal opinion, it's gratuitous cruelty to solve a problem which was solved years ago and it isn't a current crisis at all.
Beautifully put by both of you. Thank you so much for being my guests tonight.
Thanks.
Pleasure, Patricia.
Peter Harcher, political editor and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Dr. Amy Coops, Croaky Health Media News and doctor in training. In fact, I think we had her on the show the night she became officially a doctor, which is pretty exciting after you study for that long and you've had a long career in journalism too. Pretty amazing achievement. This is RN Drive. Patricia Carvalis with you. Very exciting. Up next, it's the quiz.